welcome to the first annual Pride of Detroit Book Club meeting. Yes, we have finally done it. We have finally gathered the wagons after months of waiting. This is our first annual book club, off-season book club book. We actually had a book before this. It was called Football Scouting Methods by Bill Belichick's father, Steve Belichick. Unfortunately, we couldn't gather the wagons and get a podcast form out there, but our own Andrew Cotto put out a really good post about that book a couple months ago. And then we assigned for, I think it was the month of March or April, Sports Illustrated's Blood, Sweat, and Chalk by Sports Illustrated's Tim Layden. And we were going to just take a month to do it and bang it out, probably right around draft time. I think we were trying to get this out. Obviously, that got pushed back a little bit. We took a little longer to read the book, then had some scheduling conflicts and all that sort of stuff. But we're here. We're ready to talk about this book, Blood, Sweat, and Chalk. If you haven't read it yet, I highly recommend it. I did enjoy it very much. And with me to talk about it and talk about our favorite things from the book, maybe things we didn't like, and then maybe bring it back to the Lions, we have Andrew Cotto with us. Andrew, how's it going today?
Hey.
Thanks for finally getting this together. You're actually the one that recommended this book. Why don't we start there? You've read it before, so why'd you pick this one?
Yeah, this was one of the books that I kind of started my journey learning about football with. I think it's a really good framing piece about the history of football. Like what Layden does is he has individual chapters on specific developments throughout the history of football, you know, something on the option, something on zone blitzes, something on the cover two defense. So what he does is a really good job of showing you the kind of the sequence through history of when these things appeared in football strategy and why they came about, what they were responding to, and what kinds of new challenges that they presented.
Yeah, and one of the things I kind of really liked about the book is that if you're like a big X's and O's guys, there's enough of that in there to kind of keep you mentally stimulated. But if that kind of stuff is a little too overwhelming for you, I mean, this basically kind of reads like a historical context. It's not really all that technical in its talk. Sorry about that. But it kind of rides both sides. Like it's very easy to understand, I think. And it also, you know, there's a little bit of technical talking about what each player does on each play and why they do what they do on each play. And to me, I really appreciated that because I am more of an X's and O's guy. And considering it had X's and O's literally on the cover, I'm like, it better deliver on that promise. And while it wasn't the main focus of the book, I think it did deliver there.
No, yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, is that it has a very good balance where you see not just the strategic part, but also capturing the personalities that go into this. And you see the same figures kind of appearing and you know, coming in and out of the story every so often, where one coach might reference another coach or a scheme that we've seen a couple chapters ago. So you can follow the threads.
Yeah, yeah. And That's another thing that's very apparent from the get-go. I don't know if you have the hardcover of the book, but it comes with a sleeve that literally has a coaching tree on the inside of it, which is awesome. It basically has, you know, every big name coach you've ever heard of in this circle graph where there's literally about 50 different coaches, probably more than that, all connected to each other in some sort of way. And that's something that I found kind of fascinating about the book, is just how open each coach was to sharing their information. There's a chapter, I think it's on the Wishbone, where yes, Texas and Oklahoma shared secrets and they're like huge rivals with each other.
Yeah.
And you just don't think of it like that. I mean, you think of a guy like Bill Belichick who wears everything very, very close to the vest. But if you're talking about general overall scheme of football, nothing's secret. Everyone knows what's out there and everyone knows what you're running, and nothing is really that new to the game. And that's, I think, one of the major points of this book, is that it may look new to you or it may be trendy at this point in time, but it's not new. It's been around for a very, very long time and most coaches know it.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. And I think if you look through like the AFCA or any of these other professional organizations with coaches, you look at their seminars and the kind of summer camps and things that they run, and you look at the lectures that they bring in coaches to talk about their systems, it's all the big names. It's all the major universities, it's the NFL guys. They come in and they'll run a seminar explaining, here's how we run our zone blitz package. Here's how we run our double A gap blitz. Here's how we do our, you know, how we set up the wedge on kickoffs, things like that. They'll actually go in excruciating detail. And yeah, you're right. There's no secrets anymore.
Yeah. And to me, that's just fascinating to me because I never knew that sort of stuff was going on, because it did seem like everyone's like, oh, this is my playbook. I don't want anyone to see it or anyone to know about it. And, you know, you talk about, you know, training camp, players have to hold on to their playbooks, and if they lose it, it's a huge deal. And obviously there are specifics that every single coach is going to put their stamp on every single play and everything like that, but I just think that the overall X's and O's just aren't as secret as maybe most people treat it so or think it is. And it's just amazing to me that a lot of times these stories that Layden tells is just like, a coach was interested in this, so he just dropped by their practice, just stopped by and was like, hey, can I see how you guys run this? And it's like, I thought we were like supposed to be secretly filming these practices and stuff. And it's like, no, you guys can share information. It's fine. No one really cares.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much every story that you ever read about football coaches and them coming up through the ranks and learning how things were done, they're always going to have stories like that. Like when you read about, you know, Hal Mumme and all the air raid offense, Mike Leach and all those guys, when they were learning how to put that stuff together, they would just go up to BYU and just ask them, hey, you know, can you explain all this stuff to us? And yeah, they'd hang around for hours and just get full explanations. I know that there was a story when Parcells was at the Giants and Belichick was his coordinator, and you know, some dude just shows up and he's like, "Yeah, you know, I want to learn about the defense," and he has nowhere to stay, so Belichick puts him up in his room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
there's like all kinds of stories that are like that. Just everyone is open. It's a small community, really. Everybody knows everybody else, and
yeah.
You build these relationships, you never know where your next job is going to come from.
And like you just mentioned, I think one of the fascinating parts about this book is the stories, just so many ridiculous, interesting stories about how these schemes came to be or how they became popular or mainstream. Is there a favorite story of yours from this book? One that sticks out is like, wow, that's really fascinating. That's really improbable, or that's crazy.
I think the thing that I found really interesting was seeing how stuff like single wing techniques are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
That really struck me, where we're seeing stuff from the really early days of football making a comeback with the Wildcat and things like that.
Yeah. And it's already become so prevalent, just whether it's the college game coming to the pros or, you know, like you said, Eric Coryell earlier is something that's definitely seemed to be taking the league by storm.
Right, and go ahead. Oh no, go ahead.
I was going to switch topics, so you go ahead and finish that point.
Well, the thing that's really fascinating about that is that it's this old relic that no one ever remembers, right? I mean, it's pretty much relegated to like Pop Warner type little league kind of football, and there's this one historian, right, that we read about in the book where he's like the guy to know about single wing football,
mm-hmm.
and everyone goes to him, and that's the kind of, you know, there's this depth of history that pretty much if you're just a casual football fan, you would never know this.
Yeah. And I think the one story to me that sticks out just as kind of crazy is the zone read.
Yes.
And how
by
that
accident.
Yeah, it came about by accident.
Yes.
The quarterback fumbled the ball when he was supposed to give it out and just realized, hey, the defensive end on the opposite side crashed down. I've got this whole side of the field open to me. And that became one of the most iconic plays to this date in college football. Insane.
Yeah. And the reaction, right, by Rich Rod is just,
Yeah.
So why did you do that? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, that's to me, it just goes to show you how things can kind of spring out of nowhere. We talked a little bit off air about where these schemes come from. Sometimes it's out of necessity. You know, you've got weaker players. Your recruiting is worse, so you have to come up with something to, you know, utilize the guys you have and their particular skill set. You know, whether you got pissants, I forgot which coach called all of his players pissants, but sometimes it's in reaction to a very specific offense or defense that seems unstoppable, or sometimes it's just pure luck, or sometimes you stumble on this tape from God knows where in this little town where they're trying something basically new. These sort of things just kind of come out of nowhere for a lot of things, even though they've been around forever. Just the fact that they can come out of nowhere is fascinating to me, because you think too often, I think the word guru gets thrown around. Yes. And so these people are geniuses, or, you know, they've come up with this brilliant scheme that no one had watched football the way they had before. And there are a couple guys like that, but it's so rare. It's really rare. It's normally just they fell upon something that either people had ignored or people had forgotten, or just, you know, a player fumbling can birth a scheme. It's crazy to me.
Well, it's a lot of that. And also, I think what people got to remember is that it's collaboration. It's not just the one guy who's a genius. Right. So, for example, like when you look at the kind of pass happy kind of offenses that we have today, there's a little bit of run and shoot. There's a little bit of air raid. There's a little bit of Air Coryell. There's a little bit of Sid Gilman. They're taking pieces from everyone, right? It's not like there's any modern offense that's not going to run like a version of flanker drive. So there's a little West Coast offense in there. Yeah. There's a little of everything, really. And it to say that, oh yeah, this one guy, you know, Mike Martz is this genius and he came up with the greatest show on turf. It's not just him.
Right.
Right. I mean, he's building on all these ideas and he's got all these other coaches around him who are also geniuses. So they're all working together and working hard. And what you see on the field is this product of so many people and so many ideas.
Right. And that's something that I think not a lot of people give credit to is just how important those assistant coaches are. Because another common theme in this book is like getting the gang back together, right? Like all these coaches that have had experience in this new scheme, but haven't been, you know, put together in, you know, a Megazord type of way, or like it all came together here at University of Washington or whatever. But it's all about every single piece working together, because like you said, it can't be up to just one coach to do all that sort of stuff. And not sometimes it's not necessarily guys on his own staff, but just like you said, collaboration with guys before, whether it's going to these summits or, you know, just learning from them in the past. It's a coagulation of all those things coming together and working together. Cause I mean, Mike Martz brought his offense to the Lions. It didn't work out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're absolutely right. It can be guys who aren't even on the same staffs, right? I mean, you see Dom Capers and Dick LeBeau and Arne Sparger and all these guys who aren't necessarily coaching together, but collectively, that's your zone blitz gang, right?
Right. Exactly. And I think I just want to talk about one more story before we head into our break. We're just going to do a short, like 30-minute podcast here. If you guys like it, we might extend it next time. But to me, one of the fascinating stories or kind of most funny stories is the emergence of the West Coast offense and how it actually had nothing to do with the West Coast at all. That's not where it came from at all. But through, I think it was basically the mistake of a journalist who called it the West Coast offense because he didn't understand what he was actually seeing on the screen in front of him.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of times if I'm writing something about that, I'll try and call it the Walsh offense, because I mean, really, it's Walsh and Cincinnati, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that, I mean, that just goes to show you how deep some of these offenses actually run. Whereas we all think the Wildcats started with Miami Dolphins, it really started years and years and years before that. The West Coast offense did not start in the West Coast; it started in Cincinnati with Bill Walsh.
Oh yeah.
All right. I think that's a good jumping off point. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the bigger themes of this book, whether we liked it, and then we're going to bring it all back to the Detroit Lions, because ultimately this is a Detroit Lions spinoff podcast. So we got to get some Lions talk in here. So stick with us. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. Part two of our Detroit Lions off-season book club, talking about Blood, Sweat, and Chalk by Sports Illustrated's Tim Layden. Really interesting book about how the schemes in the NFL and the college game came to be what they are today. I want to jump right into how this reflects upon the Detroit Lions, because we're in a point in the offseason right now where the Lions have a brand new coach. We're all fascinated about what Matt Patricia is going to bring to this team, specifically on defense, because we keep hearing different things: four-man front, three-man front, versatile guys, multiples. Andrew, you were telling me there's a specific chapter in this book where you found you could really make the connection between what was in the book, what the scheme was like, and how it might apply to this 2018 Lions team. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, this is chapter 19. It's called Spread Stoppers, and it's talking mostly about the rise of the 3-3-5 and the 4-2-5 defense in the college ranks, particularly Gary Patterson, TCU, and how they were trying to match up against faster spread offenses, right? The lighter personnel, more speed on the field, more spread out. How do you cover more ground? You can't go as big anymore. You can't, you know, say have these five-man fronts, 4-3 defenses, just go base all the time, because you're going to need a nickel on the field. You're going to need some kind of fifth defensive back, or at least you got to prepare for you know, trying to cover the deep ball more often. And just thinking about the modern NFL, right? I mean, this is not the old school 50s and 60s pounded out on the ground kind of league anymore. The past 2 years, roughly, I think it's like 60% of the offensive snaps were from 11 personnel. Right. Everybody's going three wide. They're spreading the ball out, right? It's not like the old 1980s kind of offense where you got two backs on the field, two wide receivers, the old pro set offense. So a lot of it is, you know, this kind of trend towards lighter and faster is kind of what we're seeing in the pros. And that's kind of reflected in the defense that we suspect that Patricia's bringing over from the Patriots, right? I mean, we had this, I wrote an article, I think, what was this, like a month ago, a couple of weeks ago, talking about, what kind of personnel have the Lions already accumulated? What gaps are there in what the kinds of personnel mixes that we saw Patricia run on the Patriots? And a lot of times they're going with multiple safeties. They're going with, you know, these versatile ends who can either stand up or put a hand in the dirt. And that's kind of what we're thinking about with these kinds of, you know, flexible 4-2-5, 3-3-5 defenses that can match up against really fast offenses.
And some of that's not really new. I mean, you could argue that the Lions were essentially at a 4-2-5 defense the majority of the time last year, really. In their nickel sets.
Yeah, I mean, that's that old quote that we got from Quinn, right? Like, what was this, a year and a half ago or something, where he said, yeah, we're going to be in sub packages like 60% of the time.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, you could pretty much think about this as, well, the Lions were already trending towards this. The league is already trending towards this. So, I mean, is this kind of what we're going to be seeing with Patricia coming in and saying, okay, well, hell, why don't we just put in three safety as a base?
Yeah. And it'll be interesting, because the linebackers that they've brought in specifically are actually kind of bigger. I mean, they're also very athletic, especially a guy like Devon Kennard, who can go up on the edge, can basically play any position in the front seven. Yes. And that's going to give them versatility to do stuff like 4-2-5, 3-3-5, whatever they want. But it's not necessarily faster than the linebackers that they had in town last year. But I think that speaks more to the versatility of giving Patricia options, so that, you know, yes, he can go 4-2-5, yes, he can go 3-3-5, but he can do other stuff with him. They can go five man fronts if they want with a guy like Devon Kennard with his hand in the dirt. And we talk about how this book reflects changes in trends, kind of long-term changes in trends of the game. You know, there's a response to the passing game being, you know, a bigger part of the game and all that sort of stuff. But I think Patricia's almost doing it on a micro scale, where like trends are going to change week to week with the offenses he's facing. So having the versatility, having the personnel to be able to change your defense every week is basically what this book is about. Just instead of going year to year, we're talking week to week.
Yeah. And you, what's funny is you mentioned it in that kind of a with that phrasing. So I'm going to quote you something out of Ron Jaworski's book, The Games That Changed the Game. This is the Bill Belichick Bullseye Game Plan chapter. So he's talking about how Belichick had this blueprint for pretty much for the greater show on turf. And he says, quote, "Bill's blueprint for success is built on core philosophies, beginning with his approach toward acquiring personnel." And mm-hmm. he says, "I've heard him say again and again, it's not about collecting talent. It's about building a team. Some players fit better into one system or style of play than they do in another. And Belichick assigns specific tasks for each of his players." Now, he goes on, and later on in the chapter, he says, let's see, where is it here? "Belichick's view is every week is its own challenge. Every mm-hmm. game brings its own set of circumstances, adjustments, play style, and matchups. We focus on what we want to do for that week, not what we did 2 weeks before or 10 weeks before." That's exactly what you're talking about, right? Is that you're going to tailor make that defense with all these versatile pieces, and you're going to figure out, you know, where's the matchup and how do we get the advantage?
And that's super interesting, because it seems like that's an incredibly hard task. If you're
yes.
getting these players to do very specific roles and your defense changes on a week-to-week basis, like sometimes those pieces aren't going to fit what you're going to do the next week. So maybe something that we're going to see this year is that maybe Devon Kennard gets 90% of the snaps in one game, maybe gets 40% in another game. And I think something like that would be very interesting to keep an eye on. A guy like Miles Killebrew, who we have no idea what his role is going to be, if he even makes the team. I think there's a chance he doesn't even make the team. We talked about that a little bit on this week's podcast. But there could be a game where it's like, okay, we're going to rely heavily on this kind of safety linebacker hybrid. Maybe that's a game where we see a guy like Killebrew get 70% of the snaps. Maybe there are games where he gets 0% of the snaps. It all kind of depends on that versatile game plan week to week. And yeah, it's just if you're changing your game plan that drastically, it helps to have some versatile players, obviously, but not all those guys are going to be able to do everything you want perfectly every week.
Go ahead. I think it's interesting that you bring up Killebrew, because mm-hmm. this whole versatility theme that we've heard about for, I guess, you know, ever since we had Austin running the defense, is we got defensive ends that can shift inside, or maybe there's an outside rusher who can stand up, right? Sometimes we see Ziggy standing up, mm-hmm. but we don't really think too much about the back end as much. But now you look at the kind of safeties that the Lions have, right? You got Killebrew, you got Tavon Wilson, who played that kind of third safety role, you know, kind of go over the slot sometimes, cover tight end with the Patriots. And now you got Tracy Walker.
Yep.
Right. I mean, all these guys are kind of these big body, taller safeties that almost look like a hybrid linebacker.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, again, something we talked a little bit on this week's podcast, just about how that sort of versatility will get them looks in the game. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many. It'll depend on the team that they're playing. It'll depend how many 11 personnel we see on the opposing side of the field. But one thing this whole conversation is kind of against, and it's a narrative that we had for Matt Patricia from the very beginning, is that he builds his scheme around his players, not the opposite way around. And I'm starting to think maybe that was kind of a false narrative we had about Matt Patricia. It's not that he'll just take whatever players he has and build the scheme. It's more, he just needs very versatile players to fit his scheme.
Well, I think it goes both ways. So yes, absolutely. I mean, you look at the kinds of players that the Lions are bringing in. This is kind of the Bob Quinn trademark, right? I want guys who are versatile, whether it's we're talking offensive line, defensive backs, whatever, right? He wants guys who can do multiple things, who can line up all over the place. And you're seeing that with, you know, the kinds of linebackers they bring in. Sometimes when they sign defensive linemen, I mean, aside from these nose tackles, right? If he's bringing in defensive ends or, you know, smaller, lighter defensive tackles, maybe they can shift outside. He might draft a guy who can either, you know, line up as a five technique, who can go inside as a three, whatever. But, you know, a lot of it is just accumulating all these toys and pieces that Patricia can play with.
Right.
And so, but then on the flip side, it's not like we're going out and getting him a dominant defensive end,
right?
Who's going to just, you know, he's going to win his one-on-ones every single time. So we can build around that, or we're going to get a Ndamukong Suh style dominant three technique that we could build around.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly about role filling, right? It's about filling. It's about skill sets. So it's not necessarily, hey, this defense needs a great pass rushing five tech or whatever, or three tech or whatever. It's more, we need a guy who can do this. We need a guy who can take on double teams. We need a guy who can, who has good footwork in the backfield or whatever. It's just like very specific skill sets that can fit into, I guess, whatever scheme you want to run that day.
Well, and this is really nice in the sense that, you know, when we're thinking about blood, sweat, and chalk, and we're talking about how their strategic response is in the current NFL, I mean, that's also built into the salary cap, and it's built into what players are making, right? You get certain positions get bid up like crazy, right? A shutdown cornerback, you know, people are going to pay, you know, upwards of $10 million for that. A dominant defensive end who can just, you know, sack the quarterback 15, 20 times a season, they're going to pay arm and a leg for that. But if you can stay ahead of the trend, you know, you're not paying for the same kind of stuff that everyone else is trying to buy, right? You can kind of moneyball this thing, and you can get pieces on the cheap that are really effective.
Yeah, I think running back is a really good example of that.
Oh, yeah.
Teams were paying up, you know, they were emptying the bank for running backs 5-10 years ago. Now everyone realizes, yeah, well, let's do running back by committee. Let's not pay our running back a second contract out of their rookie deal because they might not be around in 2 years. And yeah, that's a really important point, is staying ahead of the trend. Again, a big theme of this book, staying ahead of the trend gets you, I mean, pays dividends, not just in terms of schematically, but like you said, in terms of salary cap balancing. I think that's a really, really important point.
Yeah, the roster building aspect, I think, cannot be oversold. Like it's just such a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. And you think about, you know, the kinds of guys that we're talking about this offseason, you know, guys like Hankins. Okay, yeah, he would be great to have, but at what price?
Right.
Right. I mean, are we really going to pay big, big money for one piece, given how often people get injured or, you know, competing needs or that kind of thing? And a lot of this has to do with schemes. So, you know, back when Bill Polian was running the Colts, so this kind of brings to mind a story where Jim Mora was running the Colts at the time, and they told him, you know, the defense that we have in place is really good. It was really complicated. You need a lot of veteran players. It was really expensive to run. And they said, look, we got Peyton Manning. We're going to be paying big money for him. We're going to be paying big money for guys like Marvin Harrison and all these guys. All our money is going to be on offense. We have to run a cheaper defense. We can't do this. Mm-hmm. So what did they do? They went out and they got the Tampa 2, right? When Mora left, they said, hey, Tony Dungy's available. Why don't we hire the guy that made the Tampa 2? And it turns out, and this is what Polian says, is what do you really need to build a Tampa 2 defense? You need a dominant 3 technique, a strong safety, and an outside linebacker. They had John Lynch, Derek Brooks, Warren Sapp. Those are not the highest priced positions in the league. Not at that time, not now. And that's a really smart way to do it. And you look at the Lions defense now, and it's like, well, yeah, we've got substantial investment in, you know, guys like Ziggy or guys like Slay. But hey, if this thing works out, maybe you can scheme around it.
Yeah. And I mean, outside of this year, Ezekiel Ansah, I don't think he's on the team in 2019. So you're seeing them kind of build frugally with, you know, kind of these 1 year contracts with defensive tackles. Mm-hmm. They seem to add a bunch of defensive tackles, not necessarily an expensive position. Same with linebackers. They brought in a whole bunch of linebackers, and now they have a few. I mean, they say this is a very linebacker friendly scheme that they're likely bringing to Detroit. And now they have a bunch of cheap options there.
Yes.
Outside of Kennard. But I think maybe not something talked about necessarily a lot in the book in terms of building a cheap roster. But you bring in a good point about the Tampa 2, which was obviously talked about extensively in this book.
And I think we got the pieces that we need, right? I mean, you look at the safeties. You got Glover Quinn back there. Can do pretty much anything you want on the back end. You got Jared Davis, who's going to be a fixture for years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we already, I mean, you see the comparisons with him and, you know, the guys over in New England, right? They're saying, oh, yeah, you know, he's looking at Hightower tape.
Yep.
I mean, that's as pretty much a one-to-one comparison as you're going to get, that they're saying, yeah, this is what we want him to do. And a lot of the defensive line, I mean, heck, we're bringing in former New England guys.
Yeah. It's all about knowing that scheme. It's all about versatility, and it's about experience and discount at this point, because the Lions do have a lot wrapped up right now on offense, on the offensive line, and with guys like Ziggy and Darius Slay, who are kind of eating up contracts but necessary parts of the defense this year. So I think that's a good place to cut off our conversation. Unless you have any final thoughts about this book, I was honestly in love with it. I was really glad you recommended it. It was a very quick read, but the way that it was broken apart into chapters made it very consumable, very interesting. I unfortunately forget the specifics of a lot of things because I don't write them down and I'm bad with names, but just every iteration of all these schemes was fascinating to me, and just how they came to be, and just how seamlessly they worked their way into kind of popular NFL culture, even though they'd been hanging around for years.
Yeah, I mean, it shows that the book was written by a guy who is a professional trained journalist. He's a trained writer, and it just flows really well. The point that you're making about how it's broken up and, you know, it's in good digestible chunks, that's a good point, because when I reread it for this go around, I mean, I was doing this on my commute. I'd get on the metro, get on the subway, and, you know, my trip into work, I'd read one chapter. My trip out of work, I'd read another chapter. So it's great for that.
So if you haven't read it yet, I would highly recommend. It's not expensive. Books aren't really expensive anyways, but it's called Blood, Sweat, and Chalk, The Ultimate Football Playbook, How the Great Coaches Built Today's Game by Tom Layden. Highly recommend it. We give it the Pride of Detroit stamp of approval, our first ever. Not that we don't give football scouting methods our stamp of approval, but that one was a tougher read and it was a little out of date. Definitely like this one a little bit better. Next month, we're going to go Detroit Lions heavy. I'm not going to tell you what book it is yet, but stay tuned to Pride of Detroit this week, the last week in May, and we're going to reveal our next book to read. And hopefully we're going to get around to doing this book club a little bit sooner, maybe just in a month, maybe at the beginning of July. We'll get to talking about this right as we're getting ready for training camp. So stick around with us. Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, let us know in the comments at Pride of Detroit. Give us a review for the Pride of Detroit podcast. We're just kind of going to stick that in with that whole reel. And thanks for joining me, Andrew. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. It was great fun.
All right. We'll talk to you guys later.